Welcome to Your Family Dog, a podcast dedicated to helping families love living with dogs. Here are your hosts, Julie Fudge-Smith and Colleen Pilar.
Hi, welcome to Your Family Dog. I'm Colleen Pilar, and as always, I'm joined by Julie Fudge-Smith. But today we have a special guest, a former All About Dogs trainer, which is where Julie and I met at All About Dogs, Mary Graham. Mary worked with All About Dogs for a number of years before moving to Alabama. We were very sad to see her go.
She abandoned us,
but then you abandoned me too, so I'm the only one left at All About Dogs. But moving on from my little wounded scars, Mary does a lot of work with therapy dogs. And so, Mary, I would love to talk to you about that today. I wonder if you could just sort of start, though, with a quick description of what therapy work is versus what a service dog is, because so often there's confusion about that.
That's a great question, Colleen. And the big issue is service dogs are assigned to one human being and they do a service or a function for that human being. So, for example, the classic example is a guide dog for a blind person or a hearing support dog that helps someone who's deaf or even dogs that work with people who have perhaps PTSD or seizure alert dogs. They do a function and they're assigned to a particular person. A therapy dog is assigned to as many people as you want. They work with the general public. And the big difference is with a service dog, you don't go up and pet service dogs. They're working. You know, they've got a very important job. They need to keep their focus on their human being while they're doing their job. Therapy dogs' job is to be pet by people and to be loved by people. They're used sometimes in a medical, you know, therapeutic setting, like people who are sometimes with psychologists, sometimes with physical therapists. Therapy dogs can be used in those contexts as well. But their job is more with the general, with lots of people rather than with one person. And so that's a huge, huge difference.
It is a huge difference, and it's so often confused. So when you're saying a therapy dog is paired with lots of people, does that mean that the dog works on its own?
Oh, no. Sorry, that didn't work well at all. No, you work as a team with your dog. I mean, and with Pet Partners, which is the organization that certifies me, you are evaluated as a team and you always work as a team and you never let go of the leash. Occasionally when I'm working with children or with adults that are perhaps have cognitive impairment or something and they really want to hold the leash, I've got an extra leash and I'll let someone else hold the extra leash, but you always have control of the dog. Otherwise, you avoid the very important things like your insurance, which is really important.
No one ever wants to avoid that.
No, they don't. And I love the idea of the double leash. I think Colleen and I both use that just in general family dog training. I also recommend if a child wants to help walk a dog that the parent get an extra leash. So that even a 35-pound dog can pull over a full-grown woman. It's important to have that extra leash for children. So it's interesting to know that that's a great way to manage a therapy dog and make it much more approachable for, you know, the person that it's visiting. So what a great idea to utilize that. Now, you talked about the team. I was wondering, Mary, if you could tell us a little bit more about how you got into it. And if you could talk a little bit more about the qualities of a team. What qualities do you look for in the handler? What qualities do you look for in a dog? And how do we know if a team really works?
Okay, that's a lot of questions.
Why don't we start
with
how you
Julie
got
and
into
I roll. Big questions.
Okay. How did I get started? Originally, I had seen something, and I think it was on television, where I had seen some sort of a special about therapy animals. And I thought, you know, someday I really, really want to do that. And when I was looking for a dog, we were down one dog, and I'm looking for a puppy. I'm like, this is what I'm looking for in a dog. And I was very careful to talk to breeders to make sure that I could find a dog that was, you know, a good, stable, solid, well-adjusted puppy. And then I was very conscious of making sure that we got him into training and was socializing him and got him out visiting with lots of people and he, you know, then we essentially, when he was about 18 months old, we went through the testing process with Pet Partners and we became a Therapy Partners team. Now, you are evaluated as a team and both the dog and the person are evaluated. And I think that's the case in most of the therapy animal organizations. The idea being that the dog can't drive themselves, okay? Right. And the dog doesn't just wander into a hospital. You know, they're not loose wandering around the hospital or something like that. They have to have, there's a human component to that. And so the human has to be, I think the big issue with the human has to like people too, because it is a volunteer work, you know, type of job where you're working with the public. But the person also has to be really, really sensitive to what's going on with their therapy animal. Because your therapy animal can't talk. They have no way of saying, you know, out loud to the person that they're visiting, excuse me, you're a really nice person, but I'm done now. I'm really exhausted and I need a break. So part of the real challenge for human beings here is to be very, very aware of the signals their dogs are sending off in terms of when they're comfortable, when they're happy, when they're well, you know, well-rested, and when they're getting a bit stressed and they need some special support. And there are different ways to support them. It doesn't, in some cases, it means, you know, cutting a visit short. In other cases, it might mean, one of the things we do is we develop speeches for exits as part of our training process. You know, things like, you know, this Beckett really needs to get a drink of water, so we're going to step away for a few seconds here. And just getting a drink of water for the dog, it's not necessarily that the dog is thirsty as much as the dog just needs a break. And that's a kind, tactful way of breaking a connection so that the human being doesn't feel offended that the dog is pulling away or the dog needs, you know, needs rest or whatever. But you can kind of help to support the dog in that way. A lot of times, too, in the bag that I bring, a go bag, sort of a waste pack with me. And in that, I'll keep like a toy that my dog likes to play with. And maybe we'll take a break for a few seconds and go outside for a, you know, she needs a potty break right now. So that'll just give her a sense, you know, play with a toy for a few minutes. And a lot of times she can go back to her job, if you will, once she's had a chance to break and just kind of do a reset. Because this is stressful work. Everything. It's bizarre. Our dogs will kind of absorb energy from all the different people that they're petting them, and they get tired. I mean, she sleeps on the way home from her visit.
How long do most visits go for? Is there a certain time that most dogs that you find to be, that you give as a general guideline to people that if you're going to go visit, you should be willing to put X amount of time, and probably if you go any more, it's going to be too much for the dog? Is there any kind of guideline there?
We try and keep our visits 2 hours or less. And again, sometimes it's only an hour, sometimes it's an hour and a half. And even if 2 full hours is, you can't really work 2 hours straight with a dog.
Right.
It's 2 hours incorporating some timeouts, some, you know, go get a drink, some let's walk around the building for a few seconds, let's play a game or do some tricks and just do a reset. And I think that's the case with human beings, too. We have a hard time focusing for 2 hours. So.
Yeah, how about 2 minutes? So what I was going to say also, too, so when you're looking for particular qualities, like you talked about making sure that Beckett was well socialized, so you want a dog that's comfortable with a wide variety of people, places, things, substrates. So having those general experiences so that tarmac and gravel and grass and wheelchairs and walkers and things don't startle your dog because they're used to having them around or they're at least comfortable with them. So making sure your dog is well socialized. But what kind of a temperament are you looking for in a dog and also, too, in a handler? And how do you know when it's time to retire your dog?
Okay. Good questions. With a dog, what you're really looking for, I think the biggest criteria is the dog, I like the word, I think Patricia McConnell used it. She called it affiliative. Does your dog like people? You know, because a lot of people will come into the organization that I train with right now and they'll go, this dog is going to be a therapy dog. This dog loves, you know, is just so affectionate and so lovable. And they bring the dog in and the dog is very affectionate and lovable to their people, but not necessarily to other people. And it's always hard to explain to people that, you know, your dog loves you, but maybe, you know, if it's hiding under a chair, that might be a sign that it's not terribly comfortable with that man that just walked into the room. And for therapy work, the dogs really need to be comfortable with people of every shape and size, every different color, nationality, people who are moving differently, people who have, as you say, with medical equipment, people who are wearing funny clothes. You know, all of those things are something that the dog really needs to be comfortable with. And some of it can be trained, but you can't train in a desire to love people. I mean, that's sort of ingrained. You know, it's like my husband is very introverted. He loves his people. He loves his family. But no training in the world is going to make Phil love a cast of thousands. It's just not going to work. It's just not what his personality is. And dogs have personalities just like people do. By the same token, and this is where it gets tricky, because a lot of times people will come into our training facility and they'll have this adorable 9-week-old puppy and they'll go, yes, this is my new therapy dog. I'm going to teach this to be a therapy dog. And the bottom line of it is, that's like taking, a 2-year-old child and going, okay, this is a doctor. You know, she will be a doctor when she grows up. Maybe, you know what I mean? Well, maybe she's going to be a musician, and, you know, maybe she's going to be something completely different. We need to kind of honor the animal's normal, you know, their personality and their desires too. And by the same token, with the people at the end of the leash, ideally, the person doesn't have to be an extrovert to be a good handler. You just have to, but you do have to have a concern for people, because the bottom line is, again, the dog isn't wandering into the hospital room by itself. You're holding the end of the leash, you know, so you've got to be able to connect with people. And you also have to be able to disconnect with people. I mean, you have to be able to start conversations, but you also have to be able to gently and tactfully end them so that your dog can visit with more than just one person. Because sometimes you go into an environment and a person really, really loves the dog, or they're very, very lonely, or both. And, you know, you need to spread your dog around among several people, and developing those strategies for getting in and getting out are kind of important.
I love that you rehearse those. I think that's really important. And it's something that we do with our pet dog owners too, where, you know, when your dog is meeting someone, how to move on or move away, or if your dog isn't comfortable meeting others, how mm-hmm. to get yourself out of that situation before you put yourself in over the dog's head. Because so often we want to be nice and kind and polite to people, and then we put our dog in a situation that's uncomfortable for the dog, which doesn't help anyone. So we have to advocate for the dog. And by rehearsing them, like you said, having the strategy where, oh, I think he needs a drink right now. It's a polite, easy, but practiced way of getting out of a moment and giving the dog the break they need.
Excellent mm-hmm. point.
We had discussed one of the things that we discuss in our training sessions, too, is things like releasing hands from collars, you know, because we get very enthusiastic people who just love our dogs, and that's a good thing. But sometimes these people are not particularly dog savvy. And occasionally, like when you're working with children, say with we do a buddy walk with children with Down syndrome. And when these kids sometimes will grab the collar or the harness of your dog, and there are ways that you can kind of gently but firmly peel fingers away from the collar so that you can keep your dog safe, because people just aren't always aware of the effect of what they're doing on the animal. And again, we have to be our dog's advocate. That's our primary function when we're handling, is to make sure that the animal is safe and comfortable and is enjoying what they're doing. Somebody had asked, how do we know when they're done, in terms of, were you asking like for retirement?
Right.
Really, or?
Well, it could be both. I mean, how do you, what are you looking for when the dog's saying, I've had it for today? And then how do you know when your dog is really ready to retire?
Okay. Again, we do a lot of work on working on watching canine body language. And a lot of dogs will simply, they'll stare at the door, turning their with some dogs, standard poodles carry their tails high when they're feeling exuberant. When she gets tired, it's really funny. The tail goes lower and lower and lower and lower. And it's not that she's upset. The tail's still wagging. But by her tail carriage, I can tell when she's starting to run out of gas. So we watch for
it's things like a fuel gauge.
Almost.
Going from full down to empty.
Yeah, Beckett never had that, but Nellie does. I mean, different breeds, different things. But she will start, you know, edging towards a door, or maybe pulling back a little bit, or start looking at the door and or looking at the exit or the way out. And that's usually a sign to me that she needs a break or she's done. And it's an internal gauge, too. One of the things that we have to be careful of is when we're doing big community events, is making sure that we've still got some, to use your gas metaphor, there's still some gas in the tank. Because a lot of times if we're doing like a big picnic or a parade or something like that, once the event is over, you have to walk back to your car. And you'll run into all kinds of people on the way back to your car that still want to pet and love and touch your dog. And if the dog's already totally exhausted, you need to either have a really good exit strategy worked out or you're toast. So what we try and do is plan that the dog's still got a bit of energy at the end so they can make it to the car and you can still do whatever greetings might occur, you know, as you're on your way out of the event. In terms of final, you know, like retirement, part of it was like, I remember with Beckett, right before we retired him, it was like suddenly instead of running to the car and jumping in, it was like he would walk to the car and kind of get in. You know, it was a very, he was much less enthusiastic about doing it. He was tolerating it, but there's a big difference between tolerating something and enjoying it.
Absolutely.
Yes.
He was, what we did not know at that time was that he had, he actually had a real physical issue that we figured out at the vets not long after we retired him. And that's what finally, you know, that was probably a large part. And there was no way to deal with that. I mean, it was a terminal issue, but, in his case, it was just very obvious to me that this wasn't fun anymore for him. And if it's not fun, they shouldn't be doing it. I mean, this is something that, they do it for us. I mean, dogs don't wake up in the morning going, yes, I feel a need to support someone in a medical situation today. I mean, that is part
well,
of
we don't work. Think they do. Maybe they do, but we don't think they do.
But I mean, they're doing it for us. And I think because they're doing it for us, I think we're obligated to make sure that they're safe and happy doing it. If they're not happy doing it, then they shouldn't be doing it. I mean, there's other things for them to do.
Well, what are some of the consequences, Mary, of a dog who is just tolerating it and not enjoying it? Why is that so critical?
Well, the biggest issue with that is because stress is like it's cumulative. And so if you've got a dog that's already not particularly happy, and then you have a bunch of, for example, one of the things we do is we work in a reading program in one of the elementary schools. And if you're in an elementary school when there's a class break or when classes are released, your dog can be mobbed. Now, if your dog is already at the point where they're going, I'm really kind of stressed, I don't like the noise, the floor is too, you know, feels weird on my feet, and I'm not really happy here, and suddenly you've got an entire kindergarten class just sort of pelting towards you, that can be really scary and overwhelming. And dogs that are scared or overwhelmed will pull away. They could snap or growl or do something, you know, really inappropriate for therapy animals. So they've got to like what they're doing, or it's just the potential for, you know, harm is there. And you don't want that. I mean, the bottom line is I adore dogs, but they still have teeth, you know, I mean, and we forget that sometimes sharp white teeth, and we don't want them using them, you know? So it's, if they're happy, they're not going to.
Right.
But
and it's our job to be able to figure out, you know, that is the dog enjoying it and is the dog tolerating it is the most important balancing line there, because so many people see their dog tolerating something and they say, oh, he's fine. You know, look, he can handle that. But if you're not recognizing that my dog is not in the enjoying state anymore, he's really just tolerating, that's where we spill over into the dog's done and then we have bad spots. So it really is such a matter of advocacy and awareness and really the bond between the handler and the dog. Mm-hmm.
And it's an incredibly tight bond. I mean, the more you work with the dog, I think it goes past, I mean, having a pet is a wonderful thing, and I've had pets for years, but the dogs that I've worked with, like Beck and Nellie right now, that's a whole different thing. You start to respect, these dogs do magic. They do absolute magic in connecting with people and enabling different people to do things that they can't do without the dog, or changing mood. And they just, because of that, you start respecting them in a completely different way and really admiring the wonderful, they can sense things that we can't sometimes too, when interacting with people, you know, and the days that I sometimes go, oh gosh, you know, I've got 7,000 things I'd rather do than go here, but I committed to do this, so I'll bring the dog. Those are always the days when it seems like the most magic happens, where I meet someone who is hugging the dog and bursts into tears, and, you know, they just lost their husband and they just really needed to pet something and to be comforted. And it just, I get goosebumps just thinking about it sometimes. I remember a time when I had Beckett, back in Virginia, and we visited a nursing home, and we were on the third floor in an Alzheimer's unit. And there was a man there that was sitting that had not spoken in years at all. I mean, he just sat there, and we were visiting various people, and the nurses were like, well, don't worry about him. He's, you know, he's non-responsive. And Beckett pulled to him. It wasn't something I was doing. You know, Beckett's like, eh, what is that man over there? So I'm like, well, okay, we'll just wander over and see what happens. Well, he started talking to the dog, and the nurses were stunned and in tears because here's this man that hasn't spoken in years who is now talking to Beckett. And I mean, they were like, we've got to call his family. You know, he's just, and I am almost in tears because I'm sitting here going, this is magic. This is just magic. We've had kids that I've worked with that have been a real challenging to their teachers on occasion. And yet when they're working with the dogs, they seem to be able to, you know, it's like, I'm sorry if you can't control yourself, you know, Nellie's being controlled. You need to be controlled too. And they seem to be able to pull it together while they're petting her. It calms them when they're having a rough day. So that being part of that magic is downright addictive. It really is.
Well, Mary, I was thinking which kind of, that idea of the kid, of your dog Beckett working with Alzheimer's patients, but also with kids. What if dogs don't like a particular group of people? What if dogs are not, you know, comfortable with kids? Can they still become a therapy dog?
Yes, it really, with therapy partners and with the organization that I'm certified with, as long as the dog can pass the test, they can become a therapy animal. Now, in the group that I'm with, we work really hard to try and make sure that teams are assigned to a place that they're comfortable with. There are dogs that are much more comfortable with adults than children, and so we assign them to, say, a nursing home. There might be dogs who adore it. Nellie loves kids, so Nellie works in the schools. She also works with some adult, you know, adults at the clinic. But I mean, it's just we try and fit the team to a place that's appropriate for them. Now, if the dog hates children, that's not an option.
Okay. We're talking about degrees of comfort. So if the dog is more comfortable with adults, you trend in that direction. But if they really don't like a group of people, then that's going to disqualify them. Because you never know when something may happen. Like if you're maybe visiting the old Alzheimer's guy and his family with, you know, three small grandchildren come in, that's not going to be acceptable.
Precisely. So the dog needs to at least tolerate these different groupings. But in terms of, like, we do try and make sure that they're, you know, that they're assigned in a place that they're comfortable with. And humans are the same way. You know, we have groups that we're more comfortable with or less comfortable with. And we have some of our animals work with patients in hospice. Some of our, some of our human handlers are like, nope, can't do hospice. That's too hard. You know, I mean, or they might start out working in a senior citizens like a home, and then they may, you know, then their parent ends up being put in a home like that, and they're suddenly going, no, this is too close to home. Now I need to work somewhere else. So there are, and Lord knows there are so many, many, many places. We've got more requests than we know what to do with it for our organization that want our services and our visits because they see what we do, and it is magic.
So can you talk a little bit about some of the, kind of from the dog's point of view, what are some of the skills that a dog needs to be able to do or that you find to be helpful for a therapy dog to have?
Okay, well, most of the therapy dog organizations, most of the certifying organizations, their testing process is modeled a lot on the American Kennel Club's CGC, or Canine Good Citizens Test. And that's the test where you have to, you know, the dog has to walk nicely on a leash through a crowd of people. It has to sit and stay and come when called and do those basic behaviors that we want a well-trained family dog to do. Beyond that, they need to be comfortable with medical equipment. We have role-playing things that go on during the tests where people are screaming at each other or moving erratically so that we can, you know, test the dog's response to those different challenges. One of the reasons why I'm particularly partial to pet partners is we test every 2 years. And the dogs and the people, I mean, we all change. You know, I don't like this things at 60 that I did when I was 30. You know, I mean, it's not that I'm a different person. I just don't particularly want to do some of the things I did when I was 30.
Right.
And our dog too over time. So I think that every couple of years testing and, you know, checking everybody, you know, making sure the dog still likes to do it, is still comfortable with the different, you know, challenges, that's important. And we have had situations where animals, and oddly enough, the one I remember most is with cats, where cats will do it for years and years and years, and suddenly one day go, nope, I'm done with this. And they'll go into a testing situation, and suddenly this wonderful therapy cat is hissing at people. And you're going, okay, cat's done. <You know? laughs>
That's a pretty good signal that we're decided to retire. What about things like, do you find it handy for dogs to be able to do, you know, tricks? Do they need to, do you exclude any breeds? Do they have to have a tolerance for other dogs? Because if they're working solo, why would they need to get along with other dogs?
Okay, well, I'm going to answer last question first and work my way back and hope I remember. they do need to be tolerant of other dogs. Part of the tests for all of these organizations is they have to pass another dog without reacting. Now, they don't have to love other dogs. They don't have to want to go play with them, but they've got to be able to work around other dogs, partly because, again, like the situation that you had mentioned with the you know, being in like a hospital setting where you're visiting great grandmama, but the children are there. Sometimes I've been in not a rehab hospital, but like in a, what am I thinking of? I've been in environments where you don't expect it and suddenly a dog is there, even at the Army Clinic. You know, sometimes people come in with their service dogs or there are working dogs there. And you don't want your dog suddenly erupting in a fit of barking because there's another dog there or there's a cat present. Right. Nellie, with a squirrel issue, I'm still working on with her.
Well, how many therapy squirrels are there, really? I mean,
that's true, although there's a goofy story I'll save for another time when Nellie found some squirrels in a venue where we were actually doing a presentation and there were squirrels in the rafters. It was not pretty. It was not pretty at all. But yeah, they do need to tolerate other animals. We also do a lot of community activities. And again, when you're out in the community, quite often, you know, other people will have their dogs and their dogs will be on flexi leads and come racing towards you. And your dog has to maintain control. In terms of behaviors, in addition to basic manner skills, I like teaching tricks because they're very useful, particularly for people that don't like dogs. There are a few of those people out there. I find them very hard to understand. It doesn't make sense to me, but if you walk in, I know it's like sometimes people will go, no, I don't like dogs. And a lot of times what I'll do with Nellie is I've taught her to wave. And so I'll say, okay, I'll just keep her back here and she'll just wave at you. And so Nellie will, you know, sit on her hind end and wave her paws. And they're like, oh, well, that's kind of cute. You know, okay. And if nothing else, it leaves them with a good taste in their mouth. You know, this is a dog that didn't accost them or do anything to them. It just waved at them. And isn't that kind of neat? Mm-hmm. When you're working with kids, tricks help. And it's particularly important. You mentioned breeds that are appropriate for therapy work. I don't think there are any inappropriate breeds. We have one of the nicest dogs I've evaluated in a long time is a pit bull. And a lot of times people go, oh, pit bull is so scary. I mean, this particular dog is one of the sweetest, most lovable dogs you can possibly imagine. And she's a fabulous therapy dog. And she just loves everybody. And she's so wiggly and happy and wonderful. You know, so it's not a breed-specific thing. It's mostly, you know, does the dog love it? By the same token, I've met golden retrievers that absolutely love this. A lot, you see a lot of goldens and labs in our program. I have met people, though, who've come in with their golden retriever puppy going, yep, therapy dog. And the golden retriever is one of those outliers that, like, doesn't care for children or just doesn't like lots of people and activity. So the breed is immaterial. It really is. They just have to like people.
Okay, that's great. Colleen, do you have any other questions for Mary?
Well, Mary, I love that you have a class where you help teach people some of the skills they need, but a lot of places don't offer specific training for therapy dog work. So if we were looking at that perspective, like, what advice would you give someone if they wanted to learn more about therapy dog work, you know, but they weren't aware of a class in their area? What would you suggest?
The first thing I would do, and I'm a little bit biased because I think they've definitely got the gold standard in terms of how they handle things. But Pet Partners has a wonderful website with a lot of really good resources on it. And there are some very, very good books on, you know, training and supporting your therapy dog. I think there's one called Teaming with Your Therapy Dog. I cannot remember the title exactly, but it's a fabulous, fabulous book.
I believe it is Teaming with Your Therapy Dog.
Yeah. It's a fabulous book. That one is one that I think is well worth anybody getting it, even if they're, you know, never going to do it. It's just an interesting book about how we train and what, you know, what the dogs need to do and what the people need to do to help support their dogs. Those are good ideas. Any kind of a class where your dog, where you build that bond with your dog and just basic obedience classes. There's advantages even to things like agility, which helps dogs to become more confident and work well around other animals. Classes where you work on tricks and behaviors like that. I think one of the goofiest things, we've got a class we call Potpourri, which is sort of a mixture of tricks and activities and going out into different venues in public. And I got in trouble in this class one time because we had a dog that was a therapy dog that, and I'm going to call him Rex because otherwise his owner might hurt me if she hears me calling his name. But Rex, this therapy Labrador retriever, was a very well-behaved dog. And one of the goofy behaviors we were working on was teaching dogs to get up on something. Because, for example, small dogs, if you're working in a hospital or something like that, the dog needs to be quiet on a bed. Now, we put down a cover, you know, or a blanket so that the dog's not directly, you know, on the bed, but the dog needs to be comfortable being on a bed. With larger dogs, I like them to be able to sit in a chair next to the bed so the person in the, you know, in the bed can reach over and pet the dog, because hospital beds are pretty high, and even a Labrador retriever, the head doesn't come up high enough. So mm-hmm. So we had taught these dogs how to get up on things, and we thought this was just, you know, such a cool idea. Well, this particular dog visited at a school. And at this particular school, there was like this waist-high counter in the school office between the secretary and the like this waiting area in the school office. And one day, this person went in with her dog to do her work, and someone was behind the counter and said, "Oh, the therapy dog is here. Such and such wanted to see this dog." And so the owner said, "Oh, okay," and she went, "Rex, up," and patted the counter. What she thought was going to happen was that was going to put his paws up on the counter. What happened was Rex took a flying leap and landed all four paws on the waist-high counter, looking down at everyone with a great deal. I mean, he looked quite pleased with himself. His handler was...
Of course he was. He was like, look what I learned.
...of the world, exactly. The handler came in the next day to me and said, "You have created a monster here. You know, we need to do something else." I learned as a trainer I needed to be more specific with my criteria. We got two different behaviors from then on. One was paws up and one was up. Paws up was what we were looking for with Rex and we didn't get. And up meant you can put all four, you know, 4 feet on this. Both of those, again, are useful behaviors in particular, you know, environments. But sometimes it's a question of going into the environment and going, you know, it'd be really cool if my dog could do this, and then training to it. Mm-hmm. We start training to behavior A and our dog does behavior B and we go, oh, well, that's kind of cool too. And I mean, so there's a lot of ways we can kind of enrich the experience for both the dogs and the people that the dogs are visiting just with training various tricks and behaviors.
That's great. I think we will put onto the show notes, we'll get a link right to Pet Partners and also to that book on Amazon. We'll figure out the exact title and give you a link for that for anybody who's interested. Those links will be on our show notes. Mary, I just wanted to say that I have seen you and Beckett. I remember when I was at All About Dogs and I walked into a training class and you were there with Beckett. And I thought to myself, this is one of the most beautiful teams I have ever seen. You were brilliant with Beckett. And the way in which you two moved with each other was just poetry in motion. There was a fluidity and a connection. And I remember thinking to myself, holy cow, if I could just be a fraction of the trainer that this woman is with her dog, I will be a very happy woman. So I am sure that you are training some of the most wonderful therapy dogs, and too bad it's just in Alabama and it's not all over the place, because we could use some of you guys up here as well. So thank you so much for the work you do, and really, you are just one of the best and nicest trainers I have ever met. So
absolutely. We really appreciate you joining us today to share this passion, because so many people have an interest in it but don't really know how to get started. So I think you've given a lot of really helpful information today.
I do too, and especially because I also think too, not only do they not know how to get started, they have no idea of what's actually required of them and their dogs, and the mm-hmm. idea of what kind of a relationship needs to be, not only between them and their dog, but them and the community that they're going to work with, and their dog's relationship to that community as well. So you've given them a lot of things to think about. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. And I've got to say, Beckett made me look good. I mean, that was, there were no two ways about it. That dog was, he was a brilliant, brilliant dog. But all of the dogs I've had a chance to work with have been absolutely wonderful. And some of them are suited for this kind of work. Some of them not so much. But they're all just fantastic animals. And I think if we can appreciate that about them and put them in the place that they're most comfortable with, everybody wins. I mean, right. And in this case, the whole community wins, which is a good thing.
Yeah. Finding everyone's own personal niche and appreciating their own gifts.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Okay, well, thank you very much, Mary. Colleen, I think that wraps it up for this week, and I will see you next week.
Yep.
All right.
See you later.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Your Family Dog. Got questions? Interesting ideas? Colleen and Julie would love to hear them. Call 614-349-1661. Or visit www.yourfamilydogpodcast.com to share your thoughts.
Have you visited our website lately? In addition to our previous episodes, we also have a list of resources that you and your dog may enjoy. Check it out at yourfamilydogpodcast.com.